French.
Hey, I'm Rob McDonald.
And this is the Great Plains Outdoors Podcast.
We're going to talk about everything from fishing and hunting to hiking, paddling, and adventures on the Great Plains. We'll cover it all here.
So join us each episode and hear what's going on in the great outdoors on the Great Plains. Receiving those comments and sharing them with our listeners too. And, you know, a big part of that and what helps us is making sure we bring guests on that you all want to hear from in a timely way. So one of those things that's happening right now across the Great Plains that's pretty popular, and I think I hear about it in every conversation with my team, is waterfowl hunting. It's the prime season. And Rob, I know you're a big waterfowler. I feel like every time I talk to you, you're out there chasing them. So I'm sure you're excited about our guest today.
You bet, Brittany. You know, I have been an avid waterfowler for decades, living on the Central Flyway, and just, you know, cut my teeth out there chasing ducks and geese in Northwest Kansas. And I moved down here in the southeast part of the state, and yeah, we're after them. We get pretty mad at them about this time of year. So I always look forward to that. And, you know, the migration is this amazing thing that there's heritage and fellowship, and then there's like the natural world. Just the fact that those birds, you know, come from Canada all the way down into the Gulf of Mexico to have, you know, yeah. It's pretty amazing. Just that fact, and that the chance that we get to go out and harvest them, and they're delicious. And so I'm also a member of Delta Waterfowl, mm-hmm. and so that's really got me excited for today's guest.
Yeah, absolutely. We had a kiddo shoot his first goose, and it was a banded goose, and he had no idea what that meant. So he was hyped, needless to say, about being able to log in there and see the history of that bird, where it came from, how long it's been alive. And I can only imagine the tales he was telling at school the next day. So I'm sure he was just impossible. I love it. Hopefully he's hooked for life. But yes, Rob, I'm excited about today's guest. I know Scott probably now for maybe close to 10 years. That's crazy to say, but Scott is the director at Delta Waterfowl. He currently lives in south of Nashville, Tennessee, serving as a director for Delta Waterfowl Foundation since this past spring. So he's new in his role, and we're eager to hear from him about some of the things they got going on there at Delta. He's working to grow Delta's footprint throughout the Southeast with the initial emphasis on Tennessee and Kentucky. Scott is an avid waterfowl hunter and wildlife manager. He's well-versed and experienced in not only waterfowl management, but also upland wildlife and fisheries as well. I would say, yes, it's just part fish, part waterfowler. You certainly are, Scott. He grew up in the mountains of Western North Carolina, where he developed a strong tie to family, land, and natural resources. Scott's childhood was spent chasing squirrels and rabbits and helping his grandparents on their small farms. He remembers hunting rabbits with his grandpa's beagles long before he was old enough to carry a gun. And his grandpa always said that his Scott was the best jump dog he ever owned.
Yeah.
That's rich. He spent over 30 years in the wildlife profession, working for several state wildlife agencies and serving as executives for several large conservation organizations, including the Union Sportsmen's Alliance and the National Wildlife Turkey Federation. Scott is an avid hunter, angler, and recreational shooter. His greatest reward is introducing others to the wonders of the outdoors and challenges and adventures of being a field. Scott, thanks for joining us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's exciting to be on here. As you mentioned, I'm relatively new with Delta Waterfowl, so I'm excited to talk about what my new role is and to talk about all of their exciting initiatives and the things they're doing. It's an absolutely great organization. I'm proud to be part of it.
Yeah, Scott, it's so fun to reflect on our friendship, but just your tenure in this outdoor industry, it's pretty incredible. But talk about how you got started. I know we kind of briefly talked about, you know, going out with your grandpa, but what did that look like for you and how you fell in love with the outdoors to end up where you are today?
Well, I'm old as dirt, so I have been around quite a while. the gray in my beard showing all that.
We call that wisdom.
That's wisdom. Okay.
Yeah.
I like that better than having the old white beard, Papa Smurf look. but no, I really started out, I was super blessed that both of my grandparents were huge hunters and anglers, and literally I cannot remember a day that I didn't have a fishing pole, or I wasn't walking around behind my grandfather in the woods. And again, you know, we had beagles from the time I can remember. And the beagles literally learned to just like follow me around when I was little, because I would get in the, you know, they gave me a pair of Carhartts and I'd just dig in there and jump rabbits and they'd chase them. So, but those are, you know, my fondest memories. And I guess I always knew that I wanted to do something outside. And mm-hmm. so I ended up getting my bachelor's degree. Actually, it was pre-med, but I got an emphasis in wildlife, fisheries, environmental science. And then I ended up getting my master's degree in environmental tox from Clemson University. And I was just super blessed. You know, I could be killing sea monkeys in a lab jacket with my degree. But I ended up working for Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission as an ecologist, and then as a district biologist for Missouri, and then really, really learned so much about wildlife and the international perspective working at National Wild Turkey Federation. And so, you know, I think it was just God's plan for me to be in the wildlife field, and he placed all these opportunities and people in my path. And, you know, I've just been super blessed, and I continue to be blessed to work for organizations like Delta.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're kind of one of those few of us who are in the serendipitous place where your passion is your work, right? Like truly.
That's right. That's right.
And it's really a privileged position to find yourself in. And you're right. I think a lot of it's God's timing and listening to the big man upstairs and where he's guiding and directing us. So I'm certainly thankful for his plan for you, because I think that Outdoor Mentors has deeply benefited from having your expertise as a former board member and just through partnerships with all of the history and the tenure you have in the industry. It's incredible. So thanks for all you do in that way too.
It's been an honor.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's talk about Delta Waterfowl. For folks who don't know, what's the mission? You know, what's the elevator pitch, if you will, there? Let's talk about that.
Right. Right. Delta Waterfowl is all about producing ducks. And so our mission is to produce ducks and to secure the future of waterfowl hunting. You know, Delta realizes that without waterfowl hunters, you're not going to have healthy duck populations. It's no different than any other wildlife species or conservation mission. But we are very, very focused on producing ducks. We really have four conservation pillars. One of those is specifically duck production. You know, whatever it takes to put more ducks in the flyway year after year after year. Another one is research. Everything that Delta does is science-based. And Rob, you had mentioned that, you know, we talk about research at our events. And the reason for that is how Delta started. It started as a research organization. And every single decision, every logic model that we build is based on science. You know, there's no guesswork. There's no we think. It's actually proven. It's been studied over and over again, and we know that scientifically it will work. And then we obviously have a hunter. It's called Hunter R3 is the program. Recruitment, retention, reactivation program. We're doing work at universities, and we're also doing a first hunt program where we introduce about 80,000 kids to hunting each year. And then the final thing that we do, and probably one of the most impactful, is our policy and legislation programs, which we call our habitat conservation pillar. You know, the pen is very mighty, and doing legislation and policy to protect small, shallow wetlands is really what we're focused on, because believe it or not, you know, everybody thinks that breeding habitat is really the limiting factor for ducks. And they immediately think of grass. You know, we don't have enough grasslands associated with wetlands. In reality, one of the biggest limiting factors is actually pair ponds. And so these breeding ponds are super, super important. And those are generally, you know, 1 to 2 acre, really small, what they call ephemeral wetlands. They're not there all the time. You know, they may be dry in the summer, but they're wet in the spring when the ducks fly up. And being able to protect those from being drained or destroyed is extremely, extremely important.
So Scott, you mentioned something there that I want to dive a little bit deeper into. I think you were getting into it a little bit there, is growing ducks. So, you know, immediately somebody that maybe is not a waterfowler or not real familiar with that, like, you know, okay, so take some ducks and put them in a pen and they'll lay eggs and you stick them in an incubator or you let them sit on, you know, like
turn them
that's
loose.
How we grow chickens, right? Or, you know, hogs that are, you know, commercial agriculture practice. That's not what you guys are up to, right? So there's the wild ducks and the multiple species that travel on our flyways in North America. But what does that look like when you say grow ducks? Let's get into that a little bit.
Sure. Funny story. I've had people actually ask me, they're like, so you guys are going to produce 1 million ducks a year? I'm like, yeah, that's the goal. At least 1 million at minimum. You know, that's a conservative estimate. We'll put 1 million ducks in the flyway year over year over year with 1 million duck campaign. And the next question they ask is, how big is your facility? How in the world are you going
to? Right. I mean, you think ducks. About pheasants, right? Or you go to a game preserve and they got checkers in a pen and they go put them in the 80 acres out behind the lodge, right? But that's not what you guys are talking about.
Not at all. Not at all. And so we work primarily on the Prairie Pothole region, which is where about 75% of the ducks breed in North America. And that's in the prairie section of Canada. It's North Dakota, South Dakota, a little bit of Minnesota and Iowa. And so that's primarily where Delta does their work. And when we talk about growing ducks, we're talking about ducks coming north for the spring. They breed, they nest, and they produce ducklings, and then those ducklings fledge, and they're part of the flight in the fall. And that's what we talk about. And that's the number that we give. You know, we're not talking about how many ducks are we going to hatch, how many ducks are we going to produce. It's talking about how many ducks actually are in that fall flight each year that have been bred and produced on the Prairie Pothole region. So that's what Delta does. And we do a lot of different things. Two really primary things that we do to help duck survival. And that's, you know, nesting success. There are tons of nest predators for duck nesting. We also help duckling survival and we help the adult survival. You know, we have losses that are pretty high, especially for the hens when they're sitting on the nest. And mm-hmm. One reason for that, honestly, I have to say, you know, being a primarily upland biologist going to Delta, I did my thesis research on bobwhite quail and ringneck pheasants in Iowa. And then I had been an upland biologist, done some waterfowl work too, but then I went to National Wild Turkey and obviously managed for the biggest gallinaceous bird with the turkey. And so when I went to Delta and we started talking ducks, one of the things I never realized was that, you know, 150, 200 years ago, there were no meso mammals, no raccoons, no skunks, no possums, none of the things that are primary nest predators and duckling predators on the Great Plains. They didn't exist there. And the reason they didn't exist there is the winters were so horribly atrocious and brutal that they froze to death or they starved to death because it was, you know, it was a sea of grass and wetlands. They didn't have the grain. They didn't have the agriculture. They didn't have stored grain that they could feed on. And even more importantly, they didn't have these hiberniculum, the old barns, the old houses, culvert pipes, you know, everything that man brought in when we settled in the Great Plains and started farming. And so all of those predator populations are totally unnatural. Ducks did not evolve their nesting habits with any of those predators. And so they are really, really susceptible. You know, ducks, you know, may put 50 nest bowls in, you know, a 100-acre block or even a 50 or 60-acre block at times, you know, when the habitat lends itself to it. And, you know, they nest in grass that's this tall. The hens will hardly flush, you know, when a raccoon comes around or a fox. Foxes are primary predator of hen ducks when they're nesting. And so they don't try to avoid predators. They don't try to build their nests in places where predators aren't going to find them. And predators can have a giant impact on duck nests. And the nesting success, even in the best habitat, is very, very low unless you do something to either protect the duck nest from predation or you control predator numbers.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was a fur trapper for a number of years when the market was decent. And,
right.
You know, I spoke with a fur bears biologist at a convention not too long after that. And we were talking about game bird populations. And he looked at me and he said, well, the decrease in the game bird populations is due to the fall of the Soviet Union. And I was like, what the heck are you talking about, man? And he's like, well, when the Soviet Union fell, the fur market took a slide and yeah, people quit trapping. And so now you've got all these, and we have, you know, we've seen a few bumps here and there where the fur market's made a little bit of a comeback, but nothing like it was. Yeah. And so just to find somebody that is into that for recreation, like it used to be, it's about impossible. I know that on our cow calf operation, raccoons in cattle pens and feeders. And I mean, you know, you're pretty well overrun. So I can imagine yeah. one of those in a hen nest in springtime, it's going to eat every egg.
Right. Absolutely. There's a lot of factors at play. It's amazing. You know, wildlife managers tend to look at, you know, this is my 40 acres that I'm managing, or this is my 200 acre farm. And they don't recognize the global impact. You know, people talk about the duck migration and why is the duck migration not coming through my area anymore? Why do I not have as many ducks? And a lot of times you can look at futures in agriculture or agricultural practices, and they have changed because of a global market. One example of that is the cotton market. You know, the global cotton market is great. So people have stopped farming rice and started farming cotton. Well, ducks mm-hmm. don't live in cotton. They love rice fields.
Yeah.
They don't live in cotton fields. And so the folks that I deal with down here in the Southeast, you know, they have to look at the global landscape, and that really has had an impact. You know, Delta does two programs, our hen house program, which is basically an elevated nest structure. That keeps the nesting hen up off of the ground and protects her from all of these meso predators. They can't get to the nest. Mallards are 99% of the ducks that actually use those. Other species of ducks, for whatever reason, do not use those elevated nest structures, but mallards will. And, you know, if we put 100 of those nest structures in good wetland habitat, we'll have 80 hens utilizing those. And so we have 80% success rate. And then 80% of those nests are successful in those hen houses. And so it is one of the absolute most effective ways to produce mallard ducks.
How do you define successful? So the hen goes in there, she lays a clutch of eggs.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the success? Or they hatch, that the success? Nope. Or they hatch nope. and go to adulthood?
So nesting success in that specific instance is the nest successfully hatches. It doesn't get predated. And so you would have 80%, you know, nest structure utilization. They actually initiate a nest. And then 80% of those nests are successfully hatched. Now, duckling survival, you know, once they hit the water and start swimming around, duckling survival is about, you know, average unless those areas are heavily trap for fur bears. And so we know that the very most conservative estimate is 2.25 ducklings produced into the flyway. You know, those ducks actually fly south for the fall. 2.25 is the absolute most conservative estimate per hen house, which is still extremely, extremely successful. If you look at overall duck nesting numbers, you know, in most habitats, duck nest success is 10% or below. So less than one of the, you know, 100 hens or one in 10 hens mm-hmm. Is actually successful in pulling off a successful nest. And then duckling survival is very low as well. In some situations, and I won't go in to do all the math, you have more ducks fly into a breeding area than you have fly out because of adult predation. You know, we know that we have about 25% adult predation, and we don't produce that many ducklings that are going to actually fledge and fly into the fall flight. And so that's the reason that what Delta's doing is so important, is we're shifting the odds in the duck's favor.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. How do you guys, I'm just curious, you mentioned some of the states you're doing a lot of this work in. How do you guys actually roll that out? Is it through the biologists of Delta Waterfowl or through collaborative landowners partnerships? So say you're, you know, a farmer in Iowa with some opportunity to increase and add to the Million Duck campaign, right? Like how do people get those nesting, the equipment, for lack of a better word, right?
Right,
like,
right.
How does that all work out? Yeah, the hen houses, how does that work?
Yeah, we have a hit team that goes out and they actually identify the sites. You know, we have some parameters that are very important, you know, open water, but also grasslands available, you know, around these wetlands. And then, you know, we want to make sure that those nest structures are going to be maintained. We don't want to just put them out there for 1 year.
Right.
And so we do a minimum contract of 10 years. And so when we put a nest structure out there, we go back every year and we determine, was it successful? Did it actually have a nest and hatch? And then we refurbish that. You know, a lot of times the pole might, you know, be pushed over by ice or, you know, it needs new nesting material. A lot of times the hen will, you know, take the hay that you put in the nest house and, you know, kick it out, various things like that. So we do a 10-year contract on that. And we have hit teams. They're essentially consulting folks that go out and put the hen houses up. They try to do it when everything's frozen. That's when it's the easiest. Because then you can take a snowmobile out there, ATV on the ice, drill a hole just like you would ice fishing, mm-hmm. put the pole in, put the nest house on, and you don't have to wait out there. You don't have to be in a boat. You know, there's a lot of logistical aspects. So really in, you know, late November, December is when that starts. And then they work until, you know, the ice starts to get dangerous for them to go out on there. But that's how we do it. And, you know, when you look at the Million Duck campaign, that's really, you know, we're already doing, we've already got about 11,000 hen houses out there on the landscape. We're already doing a number of what we call predator management sites where we go in and we saturate an area trapping for fur bearers. And the nest success there is amazing. We can increase nest success from, let's say, 6 or 7% all the way up to 50-60% nest success just by removing those predators. Typically starts in January, whenever we can get in there with the snow. You know, it's according to how deep the snow is. Like last year, there was so much snow, they couldn't really even get to some of the trap sites until March, which, you know, one of the side effects of all that snow and a terrible winter is predator numbers were down, killed a lot of them. A lot of them died because the winter was so harsh. So duck nesting last year should have been very high. And in a lot of places it was. We're seeing a lot of really good production. So the Million Duck campaign is really taking what we're already doing, scientifically proven, we know it works, and we're expanding that 10x.
Yeah. What's the benefit, Scott, of say there's a listener out there listening to this, or even just for us to know, to better understand, what's the benefit to a landowner to getting involved in the Million Duck campaign like this and putting a hen house in? Or
So, you know, if a landowner wanted to participate, you know, they'd need to contact our folks in conservation. Mm-hmm. They'd look at the site. And then, you know, the bottom line is they get to participate in something where they're giving back. You know, they're able to take advantage of the habitat that they are conserving, you know, on their own property and know that they're producing more ducks. And of course, you know, we have a lot of participating landowners. And Rob, you mentioned it. One of the things that's a big challenge is finding enough trappers. You know, we have some professional trappers, but, you know, trapping is work intensive. It's labor intensive. It takes a lot of time. And so one of the things we're doing through the Million Duck campaign is we're actually identifying people that would like to trap, and have a crew, and we're training them. So we've got a you know, train the trainer, if you will, type of trapping program where we've got some of these old salt trappers that have been doing it for years and years and years and really know what they're doing. And they're bringing along the new generation of trapping that honestly couldn't just make it on fur prices alone. And so we're subsidizing them to do the trapping. And a lot of the money that we're putting into the Million Duck campaign is just for that. It's to pay those trappers and their expenses.
So Scott, you mentioned everything you're mentioning here costs money, like research, the trapping, the building the hen houses, getting them. I mean, you're talking about snow machines and four-wheelers and ice augers, right?
You bet.
What does that look like? How do you guys raise funds? Are you able to leverage funds with partnerships? And what does that look like?
Sure. You know, Delta is a unique animal in that the vast majority of our funding comes from private individuals. We take very little federal or state money. We raise a lot of the money on our own backs. And that is, you know, really my primary goal here in the Southeast, since we don't do the actual work here to raise more ducks. One of my jobs is to get people to partner and support our work in the prairie potholes, because, you know, ultimately they want more ducks in front of their decoys. And if you want more ducks in Arkansas, you got to raise more ducks in North Dakota and Saskatchewan and Alberta. That's the bottom line. And so my job is to make sure that, you know, I'm a subject matter expert here, but that we also get monetary support. And I've got 8 counterparts across the United States that do that. The Million Duck campaign, as I mentioned, you know, there are 4 different conservation pillars that are part of that campaign. The primary parts of those is the duck production. You know, that's what Delta is all about. We are laser focused on producing more ducks. You got to have ducks to have duck hunters. You got to have great duck hunting in order to recruit that next population. It's all based on science. And then, you know, the habitat is a very important part. That's one of the things, you know, I get asked all the time, what's the difference between Delta Waterfowl and Ducks Unlimited? That may be a question you guys had. But Ducks Unlimited is wetland conservation, you know, pure and simple. They do wetland conservation. It's fantastic. You know, I have a lot of admiration for Ducks Unlimited. Everybody at Delta does. And without the habitat, you know, that's foundational. And so their focus is wetland habitat. Delta's focus is produce more ducks. And so, you know, it's really a synergistic relationship there with Ducks Unlimited. And so the money part of it is really visionary. You know, when I interviewed with Delta Waterfowl, one of the things that they mentioned was, you know, the Million Duck campaign, our goal is to raise $250 million. And I stopped and was like, say that again. And they said, our goal is to raise $250 million. I was like, well, that's a lofty goal. And it is. I mean, it literally is one of the biggest fundraising goals, one of the most visionary things that any conservation organization has ever done. I mean, it is a big, big undertaking. And so my next question was, well, how much have you guys raised? And surprisingly, it's about 200 million. It's a little over 200 million of that 250 million. And the reason that is so important, and I won't break it down to you because it is a spreadsheet that we would wrap around my house of how that money will be spent, because it's 100% operational. You know, 100% of that money is going into an endowment. 30 million of that is startup money to take, you know, the Million Duck campaign and all the things that we're doing programmatically, mm-hmm. like I said, 10X. And then for perpetuity, which is really the visionary thing that I love, for perpetuity, we will be able to operate off of the interest of that endowment and produce at minimum 1 million ducks in the flyway year over year over year. And I have no doubt that it will be more than a million, but we're very comfortable knowing that we can do a million because that's based on our minimum numbers of nest success. Yeah. And duckling survival. And so it is truly visionary, but we're looking at raising, you know, $250 million. We'll have a $230 million endowment. Yeah. And it's going to allow us to do a lot of things. And that, again, the thing that I'm so impressed with Delta is that's not about growing Delta. That's about producing more ducks and securing the future of waterfowl hunting. It truly is. They are truly focused on driving those funds to the mission. And, that's an organization you can be proud to work for.
So you're talking about raising those dollars. Is that around like donational gifts? Is that from banquets? Is that, you know, you guys out selling cookies door to door? What does that look like?
So, for the Million Duck campaign, that's right. Yeah. Gun raffles. No, for the Million Duck campaign, it's primarily major donors. We have visionary people who love to duck hunt. They love conservation. They have the wealth in order to support a program like this, and they are pledging lots of zeros to help us do this. And so that's the primary funding for the Million Duck campaign. Obviously, we do have banquets all across the nation, and that's more operational funds for the organization. But some of that money, you know, will go certainly to support the conservation operations as well. And so those are really our two primary sources. You know, we have a little bit of sponsorship money and advertising money, but the two big sources of income for Delta are our banquet programs and fundraising and our major gifts. And, you know, I'm squarely in that major gift department.
Well, it sounds to me like Delta has got this amazing mission and the foresight to fund it all, right? I mean, that whole endowment idea to say, hey, let's take this this bucket of money and we're going to invest it and live off the earnings. That's a pretty forward looking, you know, to do that in perpetuity. As a duck hunter, that gets me excited.
Me too.
Yeah. Vision is good. Sustainable vision is better, right? I get excited, you know, wearing a fundraising hat right now and in the bulk of fundraising season for Outdoor Mentors. Like, that is really important. So kudos to Delta for putting that audacious goal out there and striving for it. What's the time frame on that, Scott? I'm curious. The $250 million.
Well, we've been working on it for 2 years, and in July we expect to have all of that money raised. And we have already started to ramp up the programs. We're already doing more predator management sites. We're ramping up our policy and legislation. We're increasing the amount of research, and you know, all the research that Delta does is what we call applied research. And so everything that we do, it's not about life history or, you know, how many feathers does a duck have, or, you know, what's the dietary needs of a duck? It's none of that life history stuff that a lot of research programs do. It's all about how do we make sure that we get ducks to the prairie? How do we make sure we get them out of the egg? How do we make sure we get them back in the air and into the flyway in the fall? And it really is about, and it's so complex. You know, we could do 10 podcasts on just the research alone, because duck nesting, duck breeding is very complex. You know, we have some issues with diving ducks, canvasbacks specifically, where we have nest parasitism. Redheads actually go and lay their eggs in the canvasback nest. And so that's something, you know, I mean, who would think that that would be an issue for ducks? But it is. You know, we've been learning, we pulled out a trick. We used new technology and some old technology, and we started putting nasal saddles back on ducks. That's something they did, you know, 30 or 40 years ago to identify individual ducks before they had great radio transmitter technology. But what Delta started doing is doing those nasal saddles on ducks, and then they fly a drone. And so old technology, brand new technology, and they're able to identify an individual duck and an individual brood. And we discovered some things this year that were that we'd have never known without doing this. We had a canvasback that moved her brood over 2 miles. She took her ducklings 2 miles to a new brood pond. We'd have never known that because you couldn't identify an individual duck.
So she'd pick them up in her mouth and carry them?
No, they just followed.
Okay, so they're flying, or she carried, they were walking.
They walked.
Really?
Waddled. And they may have swam, you know, it's all connected wetlands, but still, no idea. That's unheard of.
Right. Yeah, that a little duckling could make it that far.
Yeah, no kidding.
We had largemouth bass didn't eat them.
Yeah. In that country, I don't know, it'd been Northern Pike up there.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But then we had a teal hen, a blue-winged teal hen, that lost a nest. And she joined another hen with a brood. She had a nasal saddle, so we could identify her. She stayed with them for about a week. And then the next time we saw her, she had a brood and the other hen was gone. So she adopted the brood.
Wow.
Never would have known that because you could not tell. I mean, you can't tell one duck from the other unless you've got that technology. And you also can't just go in there and observe them without the drone.
Right.
And so I would have loved to have one of these drones when I was doing my research because they can fly a grid pattern and pick up every radio transmitter bird down to 1 meter. And they can do it in, you know, they can do like a whole quarter section in like 10 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah, this drone technology is cutting edge and amazing. So really cool.
For somebody who's super green like myself and didn't grow up waterfowl hunting and still pretty green to waterfowl hunting, what's a nasal saddle? Break that down for somebody.
Nasal saddle? It's basically, it clips on their bill.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's just a identifying tag that clips right on the duck's bill. And you can see it from, 100 yards above them, with that drone.
Okay. Something new every day. I just imagine an actual saddle on the back of a duck. I'm like, someone needs to put that on a t-shirt.
Well, that's one of the things with transmitters. They used to put a backpack on these ducks, and the mortality got really, really high. Because, you can imagine a little teal trying to haul around a big backpack transmitter. Well, now the technology is they actually implant subcutaneously a transmitter, so it's a surgical procedure for the duck.
Wow.
Yeah. And the survivability is really high, it doesn't impact the duck.
Yeah. That would be fun to dig into the research of ducks, right?
Absolutely.
And the modifications and because of technology advancements, where we've come and how that's really going to also play into that sustainability plan for ducks.
Yeah. Yeah, that's how Delta got started. They started in 1911. Everybody down south stops me and goes, Delta waterfowl, you guys are down in the Mississippi Delta? And it's like, no, actually, we started in Canada, and the Delta part it's the fourth train station on the train track. It's the Delta station. That's how it got named.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
It's the Delta Marsh. And that's where that is the foundation of all the research. Some of the greatest, waterfowl biologists to ever live. Some of the greatest wildlife biologists, folks like Aldo Leopold were there. Mm-hmm. And they started doing duck research. And, they found out early on that, ducks don't breed on water. They breed in grass. Until then, people thought that you had to have a lot of open water because that's where ducks were breeding. And it's like, no, ducks nest in grass and cattails. They don't. And it's grown from there. So,
yeah. Well, that's incredible. We'll be sure to grab some of that research and share it in the show notes with this episode.
Yeah, absolutely.
Some folks could get into the weeds with that. And I think there's no better time than hunting season to start doing that.
Well, we've got some birds that are actually on the air and we're tracking them and, their movements that people are really interested in that. Cause they're like, okay, when are the birds going to get to me? When's the migration going to hit me? And so we've got several hundred birds on the air. And I can tell you this, they are everywhere from southern Missouri all the way to Manitoba. Still got birds in Canada.
Yeah. Because so we're at the time of our recording right now, our opener for my unit in Kansas is this weekend. So,
okay.
You know, Kansas is broke up and there's guys have been hunting ducks for almost a month now in the west, northwest part of the state.
Okay.
But, you know, I've been hearing still a few blue wings hanging around, not very many because we had some cold there about a month ago, right before Halloween, I guess.
Right.
Like down in the teens. But lots of green wings, a few pintails, quite a few canvas backs have been taken and the mallards are starting to show up. And right here locally, those fat January greenheads show up and that's, you know, if we get a few good hunts out of those boys, that's a lot of fun.
They just start to show up in North Dakota in big numbers. And we shot 12 different species of ducks in North Dakota this week. So
cool.
Still a lot of teal up there.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool. That's really cool. Well, Scott, thanks for sharing all that about Delta Waterfowl. I'm sure we can come up with many more questions for our listeners. And if anyone does have questions, you'll be sure to ask us and we'll get the answers for you from Scott or from somebody. But let's roll into this lightning round if you're up for it.
Sure, you bet.
So these are pretty lighthearted and fun since I know you so well. And also kind of want to get all researchy and work specific. So these are going to be fun.
Yeah.
So got 7 questions for you. We're gonna start off with your favorite gun to use in a duck blind.
Favorite gun to use? My A5 Browning. That one comes to my cheek better than any of the rest of them when I've got big old heavy clothes on.
What gauge is that chambered in?
I shoot a 12 gauge, but man, I hunted with a guy in Manitoba this year that's shooting a 28 gauge with TSS.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Mm-hmm. That looks awfully alluring. That kick, that make all the noise. I was thinking, man, I could do that.
Yeah, you're seeing more and more 16s, 28s, 20s, where guys are shooting bismuth or tungsten or whatever. So, yeah.
The ammunition technology has made those sub gauges just as effective, I promise.
Yeah.
I really enjoy those conversations because I love shooting a 20 gauge. I'm pretty small in structure. And if I want to shoot for a long time, it's going to be a 20 gauge. So I just really enjoy when people start saying, yeah, I think I'm going to switch to a 20. I'm like, yeah, you come over to this side. The grass is just as green over here.
Come over to the sub gauge. Maybe we can start a sub gauge movement.
Exactly. Okay, so to tie into that one, Scott, what's your favorite ammo brand, you know, shot? Give us a breakdown of what your go-to box of ammo is.
Right. You know, one of the ammunition makers has a favorite slogan, I didn't come this far to miss. And so I really like Heavy. You know, that technology is really great. I shot a lot of steel shot. And I can tell you that the Heavy shot and the Heavy metal products, for me anyway, and it may just be the fact that I have a lot more confidence in them, but they tend to be more effective for me.
Hey, there's a thing in my running groups. If you're wearing a pair of running shoes, you like the colors, they feel good, you're gonna run good. It's all between the ears, right? That's psychology.
That's right. Yeah, and if you shoot bad, it's because the sun's in your eyes or whatever.
Exactly.
Not the ammo.
Exactly. All the other reasons. So this one's fun because you're also an avid fisherman. I mean, I think we like barely touched on that, but I feel like in most of my conversations with you, we're either talking about hunting, you know, serving kids, or you're fishing somewhere. So. Right. I'm curious, if you quite literally didn't have your Delta hat on right now, would you rather be in a duck blind or doing some prime fishing somewhere?
Oh, man, that's a great question. You know, I am one of those folks that I can show you the notes on my phone. I have like seasonal things by week. And I know, you know, here's when the big catfish are going to be biting on the Tennessee River. Here's the best time for crappie fishing. Here's when I'm going to focus on ducks. You know, before I got Alpha Gal, you know, I have that crazy Alpha Gal allergy. So I'm allergic to all red meat. I can't eat deer anymore. But before then, you know, I would be like, okay, here's when I'm going to harvest my does. Here's when I'm going to buck hunt. And so it's almost like a grocery list, but it's actually calendared throughout the year.
Yeah.
And so I don't know that I really have a favorite. My favorite is whatever I'm doing at that particular time. Mm-hmm. But I absolutely love to be outside. And my wife always laughs because when the weather's bad or for whatever reason I can't get outside, she says I pace like a lion in front of the window, like a lion at the zoo, you know, that's in a cage. And I really do catch myself doing that. I'm like, I got to go outside.
She's like casually opening the back door, like, please get out of here.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm one of those guys that just like, you know, I duck hunted for the last week and now I'm just like obsessed with duck hunting right now. If I had fished for the last week, I'd be thinking about fishing. So.
Yep. But hey, I can respect that. I like that. I kind of figured that would be your answer too. I mean,
right.
If you can't narrow it down, why should you, right?
That's so, right. I like to do it all.
Exactly. So I'm going to skip to my last question, and I'll go back up my list here. But if you had to plan your perfect fall, winter day, you know, right now, in a week from now, okay?
Yep.
In November, what are you doing?
What am I doing? I would get up in the morning. We would go shoot ducks. We'd go have great breakfast. And then we would crappie fish in the afternoon.
Okay. Yep.
The cast and blast in reverse order.
Yep.
That looks good to me.
Yeah, I was going to say, we'll be there in five. I love that. All right, so Scott, this is the other thing I know about you since we're friends is you're in great shape. Like, you put in the work, and I think part of that is probably your health journey with Alpha Gal and all of that. The struggles, the modifications that come with that disease and just navigating really a new life, right? So what's your favorite way to stay in shape? Are you a CrossFit guy? Are you like a cardio guy? Are you, I mean, what are you doing? Counting macros? There's 100 other things you could be doing.
Right. So little known fact, maybe only those really close to me or the folks that worked with me back then know this. But before I got Alpha Gal, I was a bodybuilder, competitive bodybuilder. And so I've been into the weightlifting. You know, I was in college sports and I stayed in good shape, but I found out, you know, I had a talent for weightlifting and I could gain muscle fast and all that good stuff. And I really, really enjoy lifting weights and I really enjoy the nutrition part of it. I took a lot of classes. I'm a certified personal trainer, you know, and nutritionist. So I really enjoy the training and nutrition and sports aspects of it. But, you know, just like this last trip, we were in layout blinds. And the layout blind, you're laying flat on your back. Well, if you can't set up and shoot, you're kind of like a turtle on a fence post. You know, you're just kind of laying there floundering. And so I have found that being in shape, you know, definitely helps me in the outdoors, you know, from not just an endurance standpoint, but just being able to sit against a tree comfortably for days on end or hunting a layout blind or, you know, a layout boat, drag decoys. You know, we were dragging we didn't have a dog on this trip, which is another crazy story. And we were dragging a kayak in and out. And so, yeah, wow. I got gas dragging a kayak. Luckily, we had 4 18-year-old kids that were capable of dragging a kayak. And, you know, I didn't have to spend too much time doing that. But no, I really enjoy it. Again, you know, whatever I do, I tend to become a little bit obsessed about.
Yeah.
And so the Alpha Gal and my Lyme disease, you know, that's what really got me was Lyme. I couldn't lift for 15 years and I really just started back about, seriously started back about 4 years ago, training. And, but one of the ways that I overcame Lyme disease was through nutrition.
Yeah,
I have a really strict nutrition program and, you know, no sugar, a lot of anti-inflammatory foods. And so, you know, I think that the being tenacious for conservation and, you know, having that outdoor lifestyle has really helped me to overcome some of those barriers.
Yeah. Well, it's super admirable too and very resilient. And I think that is a good testimony for others who are struggling with those same things. You know, you're not stuck where you are.
Don't get tick bit. I will tell you that. I tell people I hit the tick lottery and it's not one that you want to win.
Yeah.
Because it was two separate bites. As a matter of fact, I got the Alpha Gal bite after the Bust a Clay shoot in Kansas because Eric Dinger and a bunch of us, Nick Pinizzato, we all went turkey hunting afterwards.
Great. It's in May, yeah.
In May, and I got tick bit there, and it was about 8 months later I started having all these crazy allergy symptoms.
Mm-hmm. Man.
And so... I didn't know that.
Well, I tell all of our kids in the program come May, like, you better be aware of what's going on, where your surroundings, you know, use the proper preventatives, and it's not worth gambling with.
It is absolutely not. No, get some tick proof clothing and absolutely use permethrin.
Yeah. Well, I have to laugh at your, what was it, turtle on a fence post? Yeah. being 8 months pregnant, I can relate to that right now.
Right. You got to roll over to get out of bed.
I'm like, yes, I'm going to start using that one.
Well, you know, the image came from watching guys that are not in good shape try to set up the layout blind.
Yeah. That would be me right about now. You want a good laugh, you just invite me to that next hunt there, Scott. I'll come for chill. I love it. Well, I got two more questions here. They're pretty quick ones, but let's talk about bird dogs, because I know you've got some bird dogs. I know you've got an upland history, but also waterfowl, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Avid hunter. So what breed and why? What are you doing?
Soon as I got to Missouri, I bought a pointer, and I had German short-haired pointers for years and years, had some really great ones. And so, you know, I did a lot of upland hunting with them. And then in 2006, I actually did a bunch of research. I wanted a lab. I'd gotten into waterfowl hunting, and I bought a Labrador out of Iowa, out of Wind Run Kennels. And he ended up being the most amazing dog that I've ever been around in my life. Super, super blessed to have him. I had a pro come up one time. He was a four-time grand, six-time master national. And I had a pro trainer come up to me when he was really young, and we were running the hunt test. And he said, "Your dog only has one problem." And I was like, "Oh, I mean, this is a really famous trainer, you know?" And I thought, "Great. And what is it?" He goes, "His handler, you."
Thank you.
Thank you. And so I started force fetching and breaking dogs so I could pay someone to handle him.
Wow.
And but he was a wonderful, wonderful dog, and unfortunately we lost him in 2019, and it really has not ever been the same.
I
need to get another one, but I don't know, you know, I don't know that I'm even ready yet. So yeah. I still miss him so bad. And you know, when we're out there and we're dragging in a kayak, I'm thinking, you know, I had a dog that was wonderful. Why don't I just get another one?
In due time. Yeah. I'm sure you will. Yeah.
There won't ever be another Hydro. His name is Hydro. So
you take that in stride. I'm sure the right one will come along at some point. I love that. All right. So last one here. If you had to pick one state to upland hunt the rest of your life, let's put a little stipulation in there. Where are you going?
Upland or waterfowl?
Upland.
Let's see. One state. Can I design the state any way I want to? It may come as a surprise to you, the state that I would choose, but it's actually Oregon. Okay. It's because of the diversity of species out there and the habitat.
Oh yeah.
There's just so many upland birds to hunt there. And east, if you've never hunted the eastern side of Oregon, it's absolutely amazing. You know, you can hunt quail, chuckers, pheasants. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just a great, great place to hunt. And the terrain is wonderful. It's beautiful. And, you know, the bird numbers are great. That's what I was asking. Do I get to design it? Because it would probably be California.
Wow. But
there's a lot of other things that would keep me from California.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's okay. We don't need to get into the weeds on that one. Yeah. I love that. Well, Scott, thank you so much for that. And this episode, it's been great catching up with you and sharing Delta Waterfowl's mission. Where can folks reach you if they're listening to this episode and want to connect with you and or learn more about Delta Waterfowl?
Yeah, you bet. Our website is deltawaterfowl.org. and they can reach me or any of the other directors on there. You know, if they're in the, if they're in Tennessee or Kentucky, absolutely reach out to me. I'd love to take you out for lunch and talk ducks.
Cool.
Right on. Well, I sure appreciate you guys jumping on and recording, and I'm excited for duck season. I hope everybody gets out and gets a chance to get some ducks in the decoys.
Absolutely. We're doing our best.
Yeah. Well, we'll see you guys next time.
All right. Thank you.
See ya.